This is Smeagol. When I'm not trying to protect my precious from wicked, tricksy hobbitses, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. They talk about many things that you filthy fanboys will love to listen to. And while you're listening, make sure you follow them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and any social media on which you can find them. What is Twitter? Is it a bird? Is it tasty? Can I eat it? I can't eat Twitter. Smeagol is so sad. Smeagol wants to eat Twitter. Well, if I can't eat Twitter, I'll go listen to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. It will make Smeagol happy again. Happy, happy, happy! Just make sure you don't touch my precious while I'm listening.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
Thanks for joining me. I'm sorry about the email kerfuffle or confusion or...
All right.
Apparently I emailed myself, which was ridiculously stupid of me.
It happens all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's begin with the interview. I've been wanting to chat with or meet with you virtually or whatever for a long time. Because you worked on Baby Badass with my friend David Schrader, correct?
Yeah, I did.
And you did a great job.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the book came out like really great, and I should say who you are, probably. So on the line, well, first of all, this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I should do the intro for that. My name is Christian Horn. And I have on the line, your full name is Tim Larson, correct?
Yeah.
Gotcha. And you, among other things, as I just mentioned, have been the artist on Baby Badass, which is a book that I was initially involved in with some of the original ideas with my friend David Schrader. But the reason that I'm having you on the podcast is because you are running a Kickstarter right now, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so why don't you let the people know, the people out there, know what the Kickstarter is for?
Well, Kickstarter is for part two of a comic book series I'm doing. Part one is already up and gone and printed. So the Kickstarter will encompass both copies of the issue. It's called, the episode is called White Meat.
Uh-huh.
Search Kickstarter for White Meat. The name of the whole series is Mayfield 8.
Uh-huh.
And Mayfield 8 is centered in 1970s Southwest United States, New Mexico. It involves a fry cook
who, okay,
on a whim, he accepts an invitation with his friend to go out on a road trip to celebrate his birthday. And along the way, he just has to do a favor for him. He has to stand watch while he does a little backroom deal at a bar. Along the way, a little drug deal. But the problem is it happens to occur at a biker bar where earlier that morning he had a bit of a fracas. He had a bit of a scuffle, a fight on the road with the bikers. And he spray painted a leader in the face.
That's not a good idea.
And tore off him, and they didn't catch him. But now he finds out that at the very same biker bar, that's where he has to stand watch while his friend does his deal. And that's one closes. You know? And so that's what I'm raising funds for, is to get issue two up and running.
Yeah.
So like the issue one ends on the cliffhanger. And if you go to the Kickstarter site, you can read issue one. There's a link to it. So it's for free. You can just sample that.
Oh, okay.
And then issue two is completely finished, all penciled, inked, colored, ready for the printer. I'm working on the variant cover right now. That's going to be the next new post coming up. Okay. And I'm asking for $14.50. I'm about a little bit close to halfway there, and I got about well, it ends at the end of this month on the 30th.
Yeah.
I got a couple weeks here, but I'm just about at $700 right now. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So, yeah, no, I mean, the thing that I think I contributed to one of your Kickstarters before, you know, because obviously you were involved in, you know, Dave's book and my book, so I wanted to help you out with your own creation. But I'm sensing a theme among your comic work, which is bikers and like, or at least the stuff that you did for us involved some bikers and stuff like that. And it seems like you've gone, to use a term, whole hog on the whole biker thing with this series.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pledge level at the end where you basically get a T-shirt and a poster, like a grindhouse type of poster, and then the variants and, you know, this and that stuff. But yeah, the poster itself on the Kickstarter site, I'm working on that one too. It's kind of like a placeholder.
Sure.
On it. So, coming up in the next couple of days will be the new variant covers for part two, White Meat, and then the grindhouse poster. So. It's a good site to keep coming back to if you're not, even if you're not pledging, just to see what's going on.
Sure, so sure.
Click it, hit follow it, you know, and just catch up on the updates.
Yeah. So the series is called Mayfield 8, right? But but to find the actual Kickstarter, because I got your email and it's called White Meat, correct? You had just said that. So the search that I had to run was White Meat, not Mayfield 8. So people should look up White Meat on Kickstarter, correct?
That'd be the simplest way to do it. You could do it either way.
Okay.
It's kind of like Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, you know, or the,
sure.
or the Azkaban, you know.
Sure, yeah. sure. So my assumption is then that you are a 70s grindhouse biker gang sort of fan, movie fan, or that sort of genre?
Yeah, kind of. Well, it all started with I wanted to tell a story that had like a simple kind of slippery slope plot line where I could easily fall into this trap. And I wanted to have car chase scenes, but I didn't want to do cars. I wanted to do motorcycles because motorcycles, you can show body language more. Oh, cars have to get kind of rubbery, like, you know, Cars, the Pixar movie.
Sure.
And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to keep it realistic. And then I wanted to set it in the 70s because I wanted to draw people's hair flying in the wind. I didn't want to have helmets. So it's kind of working backwards. I finally got to this story. And I've been working on the story for a little bit. The whole arc itself is on my computer, like from beginning to end of chapters 1 through 6. Okay. There'll be more characters along the way. Like if this Kickstarter successfully funds, the next scene is going to be just a cutaway completely to a crooked cop pulling over a woman on the highway.
Oh, really?
It's related to the story, but it'll connect later. But so that's like a tiny little bit of a teaser of chapter 3 coming up.
Sure, absolutely. How many chapters are in the whole series? In the whole
six.
Six. Oh, okay. So it'll be like 6 issues once it's all completed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that's great. And you've got it all written out and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then how much of the actual, because one of the things that I was impressed with when, you know, Dave was sending me pages of like Baby Badass, I'm like, this guy works fast. Like he's really fast. So, you know, and you have this really great sort of like indie comics style, like, you know, grind. There's a really good independent feel, but like, the one thing that I noticed was like, oh, it seems like he's moving like really fast on this. So do you have the whole thing drawn as well? Or is it just the first two right now?
No, I'm kind of a nerd with, computers and, software. Like I use Word, Microsoft Word.
What? Oh, to write or?
For writing it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Me too.
I got really good at kind of customizing outlines.
Okay.
So, if you in high school, if you ever did an outline where it's like Roman numeral one and number one, I just changed it to like page one, panel one. And I have that as the script itself. And then I got a larger story arc outline that's like issue one, page page one, page two, page three, and then just blocks with bullet points of what should happen on that page.
Okay.
And the thing, if you're used to working with outlines, that's cool, is that you can highlight chunks of it and move it up and down, and the computer will renumber everything for you.
Gotcha.
So I go, this character enters this scene on the beginning of this page. What happens if I move it down? So I can just highlight it and hit a bunch of arrow keys and boom, boom, boom. So that's kind of like the method I'm working on.
Sure.
On the script. I don't have the script written out, but to answer your question, I have like the story arc, like a large. And what's really funny is that I have another level on the outline that's like in red lettering. Uh-huh. Of everything, if you were flipping through this book, your eye would catch this or that, like topless woman or extreme violence or you know, in either like red or green ink, you know, in letters on my outline. So I can
look at the
thing and go, okay, there's a big stretch here where nothing's happening. Oh, there's something happening here. Oh, that's cool. I don't want to make it boring for long stretches.
Oh, no, that's so interesting. So when you're writing out your outline, you're saying that you've got like chunks of like areas where you've highlighted the text, and it's stuff that you definitely want to like stick out when you come to the page.
Yeah.
Like you're like, this, I want this to definitely stand out. And then I want this to stand out. And so you've made notes to yourself in your script, because you're also the artist as well, as to remember like what's important.
Yeah. And you also want to balance it too. You don't want to have too much happening all at once, and you want to keep them, you know, anticipating. You want to keep them hungry for a bit.
Yeah.
Because mainly the outline itself is just for the nuts and bolts of what happens when, and keeping things straight and organizing the action of the story. It's for me more than the reader.
Sure.
But to pepper it with these little, you know, red ink and green ink little spots. I've got a MacGuffin in the story where I got to keep straight like these three boxes. So I get like in green ink, I go, okay, this is where the first box or the first bag is, and the second box bag.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and then, so that way it kind of keeps it straight.
So when you're working through that outline, and then, you know, you obviously have to place dialogue and stuff like that. Do you refine it as you go, or is that a process that you work on as you're drawing the pages?
Yeah, I think you're asking like traditional style or Marvel method.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
I do a little bit of both. Like in the first issue, there's a scene where Calvin and his friend Lenny is the kind of shady friend of his. They have a long talk about what they're going to do in Mexico on his birthday.
Okay.
And it's kind of not safe for work, like adult level.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
The women will do.
Okay.
And that I just wrote out like a scene, like dialogue, and I didn't worry about panel placement or any of that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
And then when I got around to drawing the comic book and it came to that scene, then I kind of referred to that document and looked at it and went, okay, this is probably going to take like two and a half pages. It's, you know, just kind of rough it in.
Uh-huh.
And then like a little tweaking at the end of that, like I said, like, you know, where you put the balloons, is it going to be in this panel or on that panel? Just whatever makes the flow work well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that
the reader should not notice how you're putting things together. They should just be reading the story.
And that's sure.
Absolutely. The first thing.
Oh no, that's really cool. That's a really cool method of working. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, having read a lot about like some of the classic Marvel artists that I like somebody like John Byrne back in the day. He was one of the reasons I started reading comics. But after a while, I read that he just stopped like writing full scripts because he's like, I'm drawing this. I know what I want to do. So like, you know, I don't have to write out the full script. But I really appreciate you sharing the method that you're working in, because to me, that's really interesting too, where it's like, okay, I have a script or I have an outline and I have an idea, but these are the things that have to really like punch out. And that's really cool. I've never really heard anybody sort of like address it that way. Where did you learn that? Is that something you just developed yourself, or was there somebody that gave you that advice, or?
I think just working on my own stuff and just kind of learning as I go and making a lot of mistakes along the way and then kind of backtracking and going, okay, well, if a simple way to work on it would be to just think of it as a whole project first and then work out the details later. I'll tell you one inspiration for stories like Mayfield 8 and the like is I've done all sorts of stuff on my website. There's like fantasy stuff that belongs like in Heavy Magazine, and it's really not congruent with what I'm working on now. But I think when I was watching years ago, a friend of mine suggested watching Breaking Bad.
Why?
It's like this high school chemistry teacher, and I gave it a try, and I looked at it. Now I was hooked on the show like everybody else was. And I thought to myself, here's a story. It doesn't have dragons. It doesn't have superheroes. It doesn't have nuclear explosions. Okay. It's you and I, it's normal everyday people. Yet within a few episodes, you're just drawn into this. And I thought, well, how can I do that? How can I use really basic materials and basic tools and pull somebody into a story where you're just on the edge of your seat. You're wondering what the hell's going to happen next.
Sure.
So anyway, that was kind of an inspiration for what I'm working on right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And we should say that Mayfield 8, I mean, we've mentioned like Grindhouse and indie comics and stuff like that. It's definitely skewed more towards a mature breaking, somebody who would be reading or, excuse me, watching something like you just mentioned, Breaking Bad, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just started watching Ozark too, so don't give anything away from me.
No. I haven't actually, you know, it's really funny. My wife, I mean, not a funny story, but my wife got pneumonia last year, you know, and it was like a really serious case. So she was stuck at home, but she plowed through the whole thing of like Ozark in like a couple of days because she was just, you know, so I haven't seen it yet, but so I don't know anything. I can't spoil it. I hear it's amazing though.
To not spoil it for you, but the main character, Marty, he goes against type all the time. Like there's scenes where you go, oh, I know where this is going. And then it goes a totally different direction.
Yeah.
And you think about it, it's like, oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. He didn't stick his foot into it. He was fully expecting it to happen this way. And this is how he got out of it. So it has a lot of parts like that surprises you because it leads you into these kind of tropes you've seen on TV all the time, but it's not really what you think it's going to be.
Sure. Oh no, that's cool because like Breaking Bad, actually, since you mentioned it, is literally my favorite TV show of all time. I mean, I just thought it was a masterclass in writing and a masterclass in acting. Like for me, because I used to be involved in acting, just watching, you know, particularly the main character, the main actor, go through certain justifications in his own mind and, you know, emotional ups and downs would just blow me away. I would just be like, and so by the end of it, you know, whether or not whatever anybody thought about how it finished, which, you know, to me, it was almost perfect, pretty much perfect in every way. To me, that is, as at least as far as dramas go, is my favorite show of all time. And so I can see where you would draw inspiration from that. Because like you, I had heard about the show and I was like, this sounds kind of, I don't know. But then started watching it for some reason on streaming. And then I was just, while it was, you know, while the show was still going on and had caught up. And then I was just like, oh my God, this show is amazing. Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
Yeah. It's not sexy the way you describe it on face value, but
exactly.
I'd definitely throw Better Call Saul into the pot.
Absolutely.
Cut from the same cloth.
Yeah. Although it's funny because Better Call Saul for me, the first season, I was like, okay, like, I don't know. And then the second season was when it kicked in for me where I was just like, oh my God, this is really good. Like, you know, so for me, I could totally get it. And now Better Call Saul is one of those things that it's really hard because I wait until the season is over. Like I basically record the whole thing because I cannot stand the torture of waiting from week to week. So it's like sitting on the DVR and I'm like, do I watch this? Should I jump into it? Luckily I have enough willpower and there's enough other great stuff to watch to where I'm just like, okay, now I'm going to plow through it. So that's great.
Okay. That takes a little discipline.
There's definitely a little discipline there, but it's so worth it because then the torture of like trying to get through, wait the next week for what happens is just too much. So thankfully we have DVRs now and stuff like that. But as far as your book goes, I don't want to just go off on a tangent and be talking about like other things, but Obviously Breaking Bad is an inspiration and stuff like that, but it seems like you sort of like drift more towards a more mature or like grown up, you know, version of comics. Is that just something because it's in your wheelhouse and your taste? Like, are you not into, I mean, you have a lot of like, and I should mention, you have a lot of paintings on your website that are beautiful, like really gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. Why not drift towards sort of that sort of thing, like fantasy, or like you had mentioned dragons or superheroes? Is that just something you just didn't want to explore, or you just wanted to stay grounded in reality?
I'm just kind of into this thing now. I could definitely go in another direction than I have in sure. the past, but I just want to see this one through and just, you know, make it happen.
Sure.
I kind of like in the way far distant future, I do kind of see when you brought up adult themes. Yeah. I do see there's a lot of power in young adult storylines where sure. you're limited by what you can show and what you can tell. But in a way, you're in a young adult, like say a Harry Potter storyline, the characters are younger. They have their whole lives ahead of them. If there's a life and death situation, the stakes are much higher because they have more life, you know?
Sure.
And so in a way, young adult stuff, the stakes are higher than in an adult version story. So you have events and actions that have a lot more impact, a lot more importance than a young adult. Plus you get a bigger audience too. I mean, you know, you can make a movie that's catered to 10, 12 year olds. You know, if you get out of the pandemic era and then people are going to movies, you don't just sell a ticket to a kid. You sell a ticket to the kid and their brothers and sisters and the parents.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
But if you're working on that super hard R X-rated movie, you're going to cater to a niche audience, and you know it's going to be a tough sledding to make $1 million off of something like that.
So. Sure. Well, no, I mean, to me, that's the thing. I mean, do you feel like you're limiting yourself or limiting the reach to your audience? Because I mean, at the same time, there's people that love Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and like, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that seems to be the sort of wheelhouse that you're playing in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a effort of mine to coax that audience into life. It just happened automatically. Like if I came out with a comic book with a superhero or a comic book with a strong female lead, some guy or girl with a big gun, I've already won over 80% of the audience. That's kind of where we are right now.
Yeah.
And what happens with Mayfield is I trot it out and do Facebook ads and stuff. And I get, oh, this is cool. This is cool. And then I get one guy who's like, oh my God, this is what I wanted. Oh my God. Where can I get
one? Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely niche in that sense.
Sure.
You know, like if I was doing a, I don't know what would be a niche story, like a submarine story, you know, or yeah. Golden Age of Ballooning in the 18th century story. You know,
well, that's on Amazon. What is that? The Aeronauts on Amazon? Have you seen that movie yet? That was pretty good. I actually liked it. So,
oh, okay, that just popped out of my head.
So. No, there is a movie about ballooning. On Amazon, I think it's called The Aeronauts, and I actually really liked it. I had another friend who wasn't crazy about it, but I actually really loved it. It kind of kept me on the edge of my seat. But anyway, I mean, it's interesting because when Dave and I were coming up with ideas for Baby Badass, that was one of the things that I was concerned about as far as like the nudity and, you know, let's face it, I don't think it's necessarily misogynist, but it could be interpreted that way by, you know, certain people. And so that was definitely a thing where I was like, you know, how is this kind of going to go over and stuff like that? Because, I mean, you know, the hardcore, it's interesting. The violence doesn't seem, you know, the Punisher can shoot like 50 people on a page and, you know, and we're good to go, right? But, you know, if there's nudity or sex and that sort of thing, it gets put in the back of the comic shop a lot, or, you know, it's hidden. So what are some of your thoughts on like that sort of thing, you know, as far as like limiting the audience or just freaking people out?
Oh, well, you got to kind of stick to your guns, really, because sure. at the end of the day, it's really your story. And
yeah.
There's elements in your story that are valid. Like you could say, Yeah, that was gross, and it puts off a lot of people right now, but this definitely would be something that could happen. And
sure.
It's not contentious. I don't just suddenly say, you know, and now let's bring out the naked ladies. You know?
Yeah.
Something that would happen within the confines of the story, and it is true and valid and right, and you got to keep it in. You can't start censoring yourself, because then you're really writing for nobody. People aren't going to really see the value and purpose behind it. There's a lot of Tarantino movies I watch, like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, where I see scenes, I go, oh, that's not.
Yeah.
I don't look at that, but I know that I have to look at that, because that it's in the story. That's the thing that happened with these characters.
Sure.
And I know that it's stuff that Quentin Tarantino himself wouldn't want to do to people. He wouldn't want to cut somebody's ear off and just watch them bleed, you know, tied to a chair. But that's what this nasty, horrible guy does, because he got thrown into the bargain. That's the kind of character he is. That's what happened if you include him in your story. So
sure.
I get it on that level.
Sure. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the thing. I think for me, my own personal thing was having had a daughter when I was younger, and I was like, oh, what sort of things do I want to, you know? But again, it's like, I'm a huge fan. Like, we were just talking about Breaking Bad, and my big joke about, you know, Breaking Bad to my friends was always like, okay, so you're going to write a character, and you're basically going to write the exact opposite of what a decent person would do. Like, you know, like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be decent. I'm going to, you know, whatever, feed this stray puppy that I found on the street. Like, on Breaking Bad, you would be like, no, you're going to kick the dog. And you know what I mean? It's just like, to me, and it's just so interesting, you know, tapping into that sort of consciousness that we kind of all have. That's what fascinates me. It's like, okay, in a way. But then, you know, like you said, there is a huge market for like the young adult stuff, but you can sort of play in that sandbox too, because you've got stuff like The Hunger Games and, you know, that might be a little bit too much. Talk to me a little bit about, well, first of all, I would love to talk about your creative process. Like, how long does it take you to do a page? Are you just doing stuff digitally? I see your art board, because we're chatting via video in the background, and I see like your nib pens and stuff like that. You're a better man than I, because I hate those things. I cannot handle those. For me, it's like, you know, rapidograph or stuff like that, like all the way. But do you, when you're plotting something out, do you do something loose in pencils? Do you do tight pencils and then move on to inks? How does your process work?
Okay, well, I think about page composition, and I definitely go with, this is going to be a physical copy, so left page, right page, I keep that in mind. So we're not talking like a tablet or scrolling, you know, up and down. So every page has a money shot, has the part where your eye is going to be drawn to.
Sure.
And no matter what you do on that page, you have to keep that, be aware of that, keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And you kind of structure the composition of the page so that you're telling the story, but also making it an attractive thing to look at and easy to read.
Yeah.
Now, I try to keep it open-ended and stuff, because the plans I make, they change so much. There's stuff where I'm convinced this panel's just going to sing. This image is going to just really send off this book. And I do it, and it looks, it's okay. You know? But, and other stuff that's just kind of fill-in stuff. Well, I got to do this part here to just complete the page. Suddenly it pops out, and I go, wow, well, I didn't realize that would be so powerful.
Yeah.
And so I kind of play with – I don't have a crystal ball. I don't really know what it's going to look like when it starts – getting flesh, you know. Now, as far as do I do a light pencil sketch and a heavy one? I do a lot of. It depends on what the character's doing. If they're just sitting and talking, you know, you can draw a table and two people. But if somebody's punching a guy, or if they're flipping over, or something complicated, I think of all sorts of stuff in my head. Like, it could go like this, and I start to pencil it in a little bit more, and I go no, and do it over again. Now, there's one example, not to give you a spoiler too much, but in the second Mayfield 8 in White Meat, there is a scene where a character is slamming another character with a pipe.
Okay.
And I was torn. I did this panel like 7 times over.
Oh, really?
I was at work in my day job, like grabbing a scrap of paper and scribbling something down.
Yeah.
It was like writer's block or artist block, you could say. I didn't know whether he should be like just nonchalant, like with the swing completed, looking down unemotionally and wham, you know, ah, or he should be in full force, anger, faith, you know. And so what I ended up with was just he had this kind of like pure white hot hatred in his face.
Sure.
And it was more that than the body language.
Okay.
Doing the hit. And like I said, it was okay. It kind of but that was a little bit of a disappointment on my part, because I thought for sure I could just nail it with that one panel.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that maybe if that explains the process to you a little bit, like there's some parts that are just simply filling it in. They're easy. When it comes to physical action and moving and a lot of dynamic stuff, my head keeps spinning around with different, like I'm in the room and in the space. Where do I put the camera? Where do I put the camera? Where do I put the camera?
Sure.
Where do I do spider eye view? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
One trick I do.
Oh no, go ahead.
Shutting you off here. One trick I do that's really cool. I think every comic book artist should try this if they're working on physical paper, like a Bristol board.
Yeah.
Get some scrap paper and tape off the margins of the gutter.
Okay.
Before you complete penciling that panel. And then just keep on penciling past the gutter a little bit. Stuff like say a bicycle wheel or the edge of a car or something. Your mind will want to put things into a panel that aren't there, as if it was a photograph cropped off.
Yeah.
So if you're drawing things naturally and just kind of let it fizzle out a little bit, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know what has to go in the panel?
Yeah.
Okay. And you got it penciled out. You got it fleshed out enough where, okay, this is how much of the car I'm going to see, how much of the bicycle I'm seeing, you know, whatever. And then you take off those scraps of paper that are masking it off. Then you have something that looks a lot more realistic and a lot more believable. Because your mind, like a kid that draws a face, will want to put the eyes, nose, mouth, ears, right?
Everything sure.
But you've seen people's faces when their heads turn. Sometimes you don't have the other eye showing. You don't have the other ears. You know, but and so your visual mind and your logical mind are kind of fighting each other, and you want to put stuff in there that isn't necessarily in there. That was a kind of method I do a lot to kind of free up a panel. Sometimes there's a panel that's so complicated where I know where the faces will be. I know the word balloons, where they'll be and how big they are.
Uh-huh.
So I'll just lightly sketch that and just draw like an oval where the word balloon will go.
Yeah.
And before I finish out that panel, if it's got some tricky stuff, like I said, the edges of things, I don't know how much to show. I'll mask off the edge of the gutter and then finish out that page a little more. And then when I take off the mask, I got something that's going to work. I don't have to do any major adjustments or editing, and it just, there's just something about it. My eyes, I see that and I go, oh, it looks just like a photograph.
Oh, that's cool. That's a really cool. Oh, I have to think about that. You know, I mean, the one thing that I was going to ask before is, do you do thumbnails? Do you thumbnail your pages out?
No, not really. Getting back to that spreadsheet idea, do have, between each page break of the actual script, I have a little tiny box thumbnail with little boxes inside of the panels.
Okay.
How they'll lay out. And I'm a guy, I don't do diagonals that much. I'm not into like diagonal pages. So those using Microsoft Word with their image tools, like making a picture or something with little rectangles and rectangles and rectangles, it's easy to just kind of make a little thumbnail, like you say, of that. It's just
how
the panels are going to lay out in the page itself, but no artwork inside the panels.
Sure.
You look at the script and there's this little mini page with little boxes, little panels inside of it.
Yeah.
And on the top, it'll say, you know, page 20. And this is, and I'll put numbers on the little boxes. So like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 inside. And okay. So it's an easy, quick reference to see how the page, the structure is going to go.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So one of the things that I really like about your artwork, and you know, that I've always noticed, is how much energy there is in them, like from panel to panel, particularly like the action sequences and stuff like that. It reminds me a little bit of like, you know, obviously this is, I mean, to anyone, I think it would be high praise, but it reminds me a little bit of like the energy of like a Jack Kirby or something like that. Oh, like wow. Where there's like a lot of like, you know, it feels like the pages are kind of like moving, you know what I mean? And how do you sort of like, it seems to me like, because one of the things I think is Joe Kubert, who ran the art school in like New Jersey, which I always wanted to go to when I was a kid and I just never did. One of the things that he had said, like, is if you sketch it too much, or if you work on something too much and you just go and you break it down and then you get to the inking phase, the life sort of like gets sucked out of the drawing, which is something that happens with me. So it seems to me like you're sort of like going into a page, you know, without sort of not saying not giving it too much thought, but without pondering over it too much, so that you're able to like keep that energy of the original doodle or sketch. Right. Right. Am I right about that?
Exactly. You got to balance it with putting enough information that's telling the story and holding up as far as looking like it belongs with the other panels, the other pages, yet not getting so precious where it looks like things are just grinding to a halt and you're seeing every little tiny detail. Yeah, it's the balancing game. You got to kind of keep it fresh and keep it lively. But thank you for the Kirby comparison. I'm extremely flattered.
Well, so, you know, it
grew up in Hell's Kitchen and he got into a lot of fights as a kid, so he knew what a fight looks like. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, again, when you worked on Baby Badass and then looking at the stuff for Mayfield 8 as well, is one of the things that I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, there's a lot of like flow and like I'm acting it out because we're on video, but nobody can see, you know, I'm sort of like, there's a sway to the way that the characters, and then particularly if there's like a fight scene or like a crazy thing happening, you definitely make use of that energy on the page. And it's one of the things that I'm like, oh, this is cool, because you know, it obviously that's what good comics should have, correct?
Yeah, exactly. It should really draw you into something that's big and bold and bright and just a lot of energy happening.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I personally struggle with, because I feel like my stuff comes across as too stiff and like a little too staged and stuff like that. And recently I've been sort of like reading a lot of like Will Eisner, and I just watched a documentary about him this morning, and you know, just looking at the stuff that he did with his graphic novels, particularly like post-war Will Eisner, you know, like that stuff has just been started blowing me away, and there's so much energy and looseness to it. Yeah. And the thing that I really got caught up in as a kid was like, or wanted to be like, was, you know, John Byrne, George Perez, and, you know, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez still obviously is a genius in my mind, but they're, and, you know, obviously they have a really good flow to their pages, but their work isn't necessarily as loose as, you know, somebody like, you know, Will Eisner's. And loose not being a detriment, but more freedom to it. Am I making any sense? Or breath?
Yeah, every artist has their own particular flavor, their style. Like a Steve Ditko will tell a story a different way than a Jack Kirby or John Romita Sr. would.
Yeah.
It really is, it kind of boils down to what the artist works well in their wheelhouse, and it's kind of their own language that they tell. You know, when you open up a book and you see work by an artist, you kind of enjoy the story by virtue of the way the artist tells the story. There's years back I had this steampunk book I bought at a convention, Manuel Carceas, I want to say. See if I can yank it. Hang on. Here we go. Yeah. See if I can, like that. Captain Swing is very steampunk. Like,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's insanely detailed, but the fight scenes and the action scenes are clunky as all hell. You know, it's just, okay, guy's punching another guy, but I don't care. Cause I love the insane intensity of the line work and the inking. And sure. I just want to keep reading page after page of this and go with it. It was just something that just blew me away with the style. So that could be an example of, if you're true to yourself as an artist and this is what you are, this is the kind of story you're going to tell. And it's richer for that. It doesn't necessarily have to follow the same methodology as a Jack Kirby or Will Eisner. There's parts in your art, Christian, that you think could use some polishing. You know, certainly that's your direction. You know, that's the area that you're trying to, you know, work on and get better at. And we all have that. We all have our weaknesses. You know, everybody will look at your art and go, oh, that's great. But you look at it and go, I know there's this and this and this.
Oh, my God. You don't even know how much I look at my stuff. And I'm just like, you know, you don't know how many times I've ripped up a drawing. And my wife has been like, what are you doing? You know, and I'm just like, no, I hate it. Like, and, you know, to my detriment, I mean, I'm very neurotic about my own art, like neurotic. I take forever to do something. I cannot let things go. And that is one of the things that, you know, I look at an artist like you and I admire it very much, because I'm like, wow, he's like moving. He's like really putting this out. You know what I mean? And it seems like there's a freedom to what you do that I look at myself and I'm like, yeah, I'm not there. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't know if I'll get there. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was your inking. Now, you ink traditionally, correct?
Yeah.
And then you scan into Photoshop later? Is that?
Yeah, that's after the inking, then it becomes digital. I scan into Photoshop and put in the color. It's really a messy process. I mean, there's spots and ink blots and the crooked lines and like the whole freaking page itself gets scanned and then mosaiced into Photoshop, and I straighten it out and make it look really pretty. I'll actually take lines that didn't ink very well, I'll put a Photoshop line in instead. One cool technique I learned.
Cheater.
I didn't use white ink at all. I want to do a chain link fence against a night sky, I would just do it in black ink. And then in Photoshop, select it and hit, what's it, reverse?
Inverse. Yeah.
Inverse. Yeah. Because I've used white ink and the scanner just blasts right through it. And you can see behind it.
Sure.
It didn't really work that well. So I just say, oh, hell with it. Nobody's going to see the original art and compare it to the comic. You know, what matters is what it looks like when it's finished. And it's interesting you brought that up, though, is that my comics, I use a lot of colored lines and effects like that. All of that is black line on the original.
Yeah.
If somebody's sitting by a campfire, I'll just draw the fire and the logs and the people all black ink. And then after it gets scanned in Photoshop, I'll select whatever's going to be color and separate that in a different layer. And then using masking techniques, you know, I can color it any color I want.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, it's a half physical, but half digital process.
Sure. 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 And what are you, I can see your drawing table over there, but you've got like, are you inking like with nibs and stuff? Is that, and brushes and all that?
Yeah. Just your basic calligraphy nibs that you practice.
Oh, wow.
You know,
how do you have the patience?
Old English writing.
Because those things drive me crazy, and it is to my detriment, you know?
Well, I guess I got used to it because I tried. I'm worried about too much software. Like if I had a tablet, I would get a page just perfect, and I hit the wrong button and erase the whole thing, you know? I'm nervous about that stuff. I back up all the time, and I have
me too.
Google Docs. I back up on Google Docs, and because no telling what's going to happen with the digital. But I'd like to get into digital more, but I just, you know, I find this method is working for good or for bad. You know, it's just something that I'm used to at this point.
Sure. And were you, because on your site, and wait, what's your site's URL? Because we haven't said that. People should go to your site.
The URL, it's timsnotebook.com.
Okay. And you've got paintings on there. So what I was curious about is, have you always been into comics? I mean, or a comics relatively new thing? I mean, you've got lots of paintings, which I would imagine take a very long time to paint. And they're all, you know, really, really nice. So I'm just saying, what I'm curious about is, were you into painting first? Were you into comics first? Obviously, you're an artist. You know, there's artistry there. But, you know, some people don't discover comics till later. Some people start off in comics and then want to paint. Like, how did that work for you?
Well, I was doing a little bit of both, but mainly painting, because I thought I'd become a fine artist, and that didn't really work out that well.
Okay.
But I found there was a huge disadvantage with painting and going to art school, is that my ego kept getting your feelings and thoughts behind the painting itself become really precious, and you get kind of locked into everything about it. Comics, to me, were a little bit freer, that it's, like, for example, okay, like if you make a painting and hang it on the wall, somebody will glance at it, then they'll think about you as the artist and what were you feeling, what were you thinking. It becomes directed at you. Whereas you make a comic, hand it in somebody's hands, they forget about you. They're reading the story about the characters and what they're doing and interacting. And so it's this thing where you're kind of free from having to be put in the spotlight yourself. As you can be like the Wizard of Oz, you can be in the background, you know, pulling the strings and making it happen. And I found that a little more appealing than a painting. Plus, with a painting, I would finish one and I'd like it and everything, but I always wanted to see what happens next in the painting. Like, if I could go in that room and turn around the corner, but I didn't feel like making another painting.
So you've never thought about like making a comic, like out of like doing the Alex Ross thing, like just doing
No. But but I'm saying, like, the advantage of a comic is that by nature it isn't just one scene. It's more of a story told within this imaginary scene, imaginary physical space, and you're free to see what happens next, the sequential aspect of it.
Yeah.
Appeal to me more than painting. So I guess to answer your question, I haven't really done painting for 11 years. I've pretty much focused more on the comic book stuff from like 2010 on.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Gotcha. And so what comics were you into when you were younger, or what is it that got you into comics? Which comics?
Like underground mainly, and some superhero stuff.
Sure. Well, what sticks out, like, as far, like, do you remember? Because I know that I'm me and a lot of other comic fans, you know, what's the first thing that you remember being like, oh, this is amazing, like, I love this, you know?
Some of the underground comics, like Zippy the Pinhead and Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers.
Yeah, that seems in your wheelhouse when I look at your, yeah.
And recently I got a reprint last week in the mail. I'm going to read through it again. R. Rand Holmes had this fantastic kind of Wally Wood style level of perfection and technique. It's a very raunchy kind of dirty story like told in the 70s.
Okay.
But I'm going to go through that again and read it. He was kind of a hero of mine as far as the style went.
Yeah.
Making it very, very gritty, very real, very like centered in this kind of, this mass, this kind of believable substance in his work.
Yeah.
That blew me away. I had this book that was like a catalog of all the underground comic book artists I went and bought in high school when I was 16. That just really became like my Bible in a way.
That's okay.
Kind of poured over it. Now, you know, on time to time, I'd buy off the rack stuff that was standard for the day, like your superhero, Doctor Strange or Spider-Man. I get into that, but it was mainly, like you say, the underground stuff that kind of flipped my wig more.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, you could see that a little very much in your work, where I remember Dave sending me the first pages that you had done, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, this is a different, this is cool. Like, it's, you know, it looks very, like, you know, and not in a detrimental way. It looks underground. It looks, you know, very, like, raw and, you know, sort of, you know, very, like I said, like, with an energy and a punch that, you know, it should have. So that's really great. Yeah, no, and it matches the style for the biker thing. I was just like, oh, like, I mean, because I know you did some of that on Baby Badass, but, like, when I looked at your Mayfield 8 stuff, it looked like this is you unhinged. Like, I'm going to have fun with this. Like, I'm just going to do my own thing and go crazy. And there's going to be chains and guns and, you know,
mm-hmm.
leather and, you know, like all that sort of thing. So it just seemed like totally up your alley. What are some of the responses you've gotten to the book that are out there? Because you've done one issue, correct? And this is for the second. I mean, every once in a while you get somebody that's like, oh my God, this is great. Like, this is what I want, right?
Yeah, very positive response. Like a lot of gearheads, a lot of guys that wrench on bicycles, people who don't normally read comic books, but they'd be into that type of kind of story.
Have you gone to biker shows?
No.
That's a plan. When all this is over, when all this COVID-19 stuff is over, you got to go to a biker show or a leather show or, you know, stuff like that. Take your book there, because I'm sure people would go totally apeshit for it. Because it looks like right up their alley. I mean, that's one of the things that I've started noticing about myself, or just noticing about comics. It's like, yeah, we focus on the comic conventions and the big, you know, San Diego Comic Cons, but there's all these other outlets for books, particularly stuff like yours, or, you know, the type of sort of thing I'm doing on the side. There's a whole other audience there that might be interested in that, that a lot of us tend to ignore, right?
Yeah, and it's all about building that audience too. Like going to them and giving them more than they expect, and really giving them a satisfying experience. And they'll remember you and they'll go, oh yeah, Tim Larson, he had that story. Oh yeah, there's another one? Oh great, I want it.
Keeping
it fresh.
Absolutely. So when I think of biker gangs, it's funny because the first thing that pops into my head is the climactic fight scene at the end of Cannonball Run, which I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
No, but I know Cannonball Run. I don't remember the end.
There's a huge fight scene, like with Roger Moore and Jackie Chan and Burt Reynolds, and it's like at a biker gang thing, and you know they're all bikers. And I seem to remember one of my favorite movies as a kid, which I actually have on Blu-ray and I have not watched in ages, is Every Which Way But Loose.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
With Clint Eastwood and the orangutan. but like, are there any? What are some of the things that sort of informed you as far as like when you set out to create this? I mean, obviously you're a fan of this sort of thing. Is there a movie or a group of movies or books or, you know, things like that that inspired you when, you know, I mean, obviously you wanted to draw, you know, long hair in the wind and bikes as opposed to cars. But were there any sort of like, was there any media that you were like, oh yeah, bike, like what is your favorite biker gang movie, or do you have one or that sort of thing?
Well, I liked Easy Rider just as a movie. More of a like an art movie when you really look at it. It's got experimental editing and jump cuts and like simulated acid trips.
Sure.
It's not really an action movie. And there's a lot of like interesting kind of metaphors put in the movie. Like they're changing the wheel on the motorcycle while at the stable they're reshoeing a horse, you know, across, like, you know, get it, you know, it's the motorcycle's like a horse and, you know, it's so great.
It's the new horse.
And like long before MTV, the movie spliced a lot of music. Like, the music was much more like Jimi Hendrix and the Byrds, and it was the experience of, like, listening to music almost as much, like an episode of Miami Vice, you know, you're listening to music and watching the videos, and it's a blend. It's not so much a story as its sound kind of put together. But anyway, you know, that aside, I guess the output in Quentin Tarantino influenced me a lot. Like just his getting to the point. That's what I appreciate about all his movies. None of it's this preamble, everything just boom, right to the point. You know, we cut away all the fat. And then, what was I thinking about? Quentin Tarantino and the Easy Rider. I did a little bit of research, which was really eye-opening. You know, years ago, I read Hunter Thompson's Hell's Angels book, where he traveled with them, 1960.
Oh, okay.
Also, the leader, ex-leader, Sonny Barger, wrote his own story about his experience, like how he started the Hell's Angels.
Okay.
Way back in like 1958 and going up to the 70s. And then I read a couple books that were cops that went underground as exposés trying to uncover illicit, you know, theft of motorcycles and stuff and guns and drug traffic. And those are interesting too. What's interesting about but it is that both sides, like Sonny Barger's story, tells a more innocent story. Like, we're just a bunch of people that don't fit in. We want to do our own thing and be away from citizens, you know, just leave us alone.
Sure.
Where the cop story is like, you know, this is a vast network of organized criminals who are dollars, and neither of them are really telling the true story. But what's funny about the cop side is, like, you know, all this stuff is happening under our noses, and I went underground, and let me tell you about it. I'll make $1 million off of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, yeah, you're kind of profiting by the same
ground. Did you ever watch, what was the show about the biker? Because I never watched it and I always wanted to. There's the Mayans now, but it was before that. What was it called?
There's Sons of Anarchy now.
Sons of Anarchy. Did you watch that?
You know, I want to be charitable. I watch an episode or two, but the writing, I have to be honest, the writing is just kind of eh.
Okay. Yeah.
Visually, it's beautiful. The acting is great, you know, and the cinematography is right up there.
Yeah,
it's great to look at, but I to be honest, I haven't really gone through an entire episode, start to finish.
Sure,
because
I've never had the opportunity to watch it.
And I think the writers really haven't they haven't done the research. They haven't really answered the why as why their characters do what they want. I did on my comic book, on my email subscriber list, I had a review of Sons of Anarchy trade comic books. And my big question was, like, why are they in a biker gang?
Gotcha.
What is it about being undercover in a group of guys that are doing X, Y, or Z that is an advantage versus just simply, you know, doing it without the patches and the membership and all that? And I just really couldn't answer that question. Like, the Hell's Angels of Sonny Barger, it's easy to answer. Well, society in 1950 and 1960 was going in two directions. There was the, you know, mission to the moon and straight laced and be Republican and, you know, be a good citizen and obey the rules and be a, you know, you know, or you can be a long-haired acid hippie, you can just ignore all of that and be in your own club. Where if some shit happens to you, well, it's going to be repaid 10 times by the people in your club, so people know about that and then they stay the fuck away. There's an interesting section, like the Hell's Angels got a really bad rap at the Rolling Stones Altamont concert, and Sonny Barger's version was that it was set up really, really bad, and the stage wasn't really that high. It was like 2 feet off the ground, and the crowd was getting unruly, and the Stones just kept on sitting in their trailer hours and hours and hours, and this crowd was getting out of control.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, you hear one side, you hear the other side, and I think that, for me, that kind of informed me. I'm not going to make a judgment on anybody, but at least you kind of see things where you go, oh, okay, I see at least where somebody's head is at, why they had to form the Hell's Angels, or why there are the Mayans or the pagans, you know.
Sure.
When I did Mayfield 8 and I started writing the outlines, the Banshees is my biker gang.
Yeah.
I Googled extensively up and down, make sure there are no
there was nobody, you didn't want any bikers coming after you. Well,
relationship whatsoever.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, whenever the COVID-19 stuff is over, I think you should hit biker shows, biker gang shows, all that sort of thing, because I think this is would be up any biker's alley, and not just bikers. I mean, I think fans of, like, fun, crazy, you know, mature comics will probably really like this. I mean, I've been exposed to your work through Baby Badass. I haven't read Mayfield 8, but I've supported it on Kickstarter. I really hope to see the first two issues in print because I didn't even know that the first issue was happening. So, you know, thank you for keeping me on your email list.
You don't have issue one?
No, I do not. I do not. Oh, no, no.
Email me your address. I'll send you a copy.
Okay, well, you have my email address. So that's how I contacted
your fiscal address.
Oh, no. Well, I'm supporting it. So when it's done, you know, well, you can send it to me then. But either way, everyone should go to Kickstarter. And the way I found it was searching white meat. That was the title that I found. Because when I typed in Mayfield 8, I found your other Kickstarters. But either way, it's Mayfield 8 or white meat. Is there anything else you would like to say about your project before we kind of sign off? Because I've had you here for an hour, so, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great story, and it is all finished. It's like in the can, as they say.
Yeah.
And I found a great printer. This isn't long done in China, shipped on a boat kind of stuff. This is scanned, and scanning technology has gotten up there so high in quality that it's you can't tell it apart from offset litho.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
This is that this thing will get cranked out in a quick turnaround time.
Sure.
So we're talking like August, you know, late August, you'll get it in your hands. So I'm at 700 right now, and I want 1450, so we're just 750 away. And I got some pledge level rewards I want to roll out later. They're kind of secret, but I'm toying with the idea of slipping in two more pages in the story.
Okay.
Of you as the character.
I see. Yeah.
They always have you as a character in my story, but not really. You're kind of slipped in there in the background and stuff, but this will actually be really you.
Yeah.
Doing something for two pages.
Oh, that's cool.
So, and I'm toying with like what that level should be, how much should it cost and all that. But right now I'm trying to finish the variant covers for White Meat, you know, part two, and that Lighthouse poster. So.
Oh, cool. No, that's great. That's great. Well, the little piece of advice beyond going to biker shows that I would want to give you is I think you should send an issue to Quentin Tarantino's production company and Robert Rodriguez's production company. And I think you should get them on board because I think this is totally up their alley. And I think this is something that would be up the alley of anybody who's interested in all those sorts of things. So again, everyone should go to Kickstarter, look up Mayfield 8 or White Meat. Because it is literally the only thing on Kickstarter called White Meat. I can't imagine that somebody else is working on a project called White Meat. But either way, Tim, you know, I wish you the best of luck. I mean, it's great meeting you virtually. We're kind of doing video, so he's seeing me and my hand gesticulations, and I'm seeing him. You know, I have had Tim Larson on the line. He is the creator of Mayfield 8. He's also done work on a book that is very dear to me called Baby Badass. And this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. And we will be back soon with another episode. Make sure to go to Kickstarter and look up White Meat. Thanks for listening.
By June 30th. June 30th.
Oh, yeah. Mayfield 8. Bye.